Happy Monday, everybody. How are you doing?
Doing great, Joe. Welcome, Catherine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Good to see you again. How's things?
It's good. The spring has sprung in Berlin, so nobody here can complain. Spring vibes in Berlin are like the best because everybody runs outside to the sun because we haven't seen it in like 6 months, and a delightful vibe.
As I'm envisioning moths sort of circling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Joe got to see that on his trip to Berlin a bit for May Day, you know?
Oh, geez. I didn't even realize what May Day was. Catherine takes me around Berlin and I'm just like, dear God, the whole city is like just a gigantic party. So in a cool way. Yeah. Berlin's awesome, though. I can't wait to get back there. I wish you can be back there this summer. So, yeah, should be fun. Matt, how was your weekend?
My weekend was very nice. Yeah, just got outside a lot, basically. So that was cool. Fantastic. Yeah,
that's great. Are you going to watch the eclipse today?
Probably not. I don't think it's going to be very dramatic in this area. And I don't have special glasses, you know, so you don't burn your retinas on all that stuff. How about you?
I don't know. We'll be able to see much in Utah. I don't think it's going over Utah very well, but I'm going to go outside and try and stare at it for a bit with or without glasses.
What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, I don't know. I remember I caught the eclipse in Wyoming. What was it? 2017, I think it was.
That one. Yeah, there. Yeah, that was very dramatic. Like the birds went silent and the whole everything.
Were you up there with me for that one?
No. I mean, in Utah, it was strong enough that you could just walk outside and see it. You know, could see the whole world going. Yeah.
So yeah, it was crazy. Like all of a sudden, when the eclipse, because we were in the totality of it, happened to coincidentally have property up there, so we just went up there, and it was the craziest thing. So all of a sudden the eclipse happens and you just hear crickets. Yeah. Like literally crickets outside, and it's daytime. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And then it goes away, then everything's back to normal, then there's like a million tourists leaving trying to get out. So it's pretty cool. So anyone who's watching the eclipse, I hope that you enjoy yourself, don't burn your retinas out, or do whatever you're into. I don't care. So
you heard it here first. You're getting the best healthcare advice from Joe.
Yeah, it's like whatever you're into. Cool. Well, on to more important matters. Catherine, we're going to talk about, are we solving the right problems with AI?
Indeed.
So it's really a yes or no question. So I guess we can just answer it and move on.
So. I mean, there's a spectrum between yes and no, right? So, I mean, I guess I know that this audience is used to Joe's hot takes. And so I propose the question as maybe a bit of a friendly conversation / debate. Cool. So I guess I first ask you, Joe, do you think we're solving the quote unquote right problems with AI?
Okay, so if we're going to take a kind of a debate stance here, maybe a Lincoln Douglas style, I'll have to take the affirmative that, yes, we are solving the right problems with AI. And then I guess you're going to take the counter argument that we're not, and Matt will be the mediator here. Yeah. So I want to do that. Okay. you know, sometimes I think we're solving problems with AI. I think it depends on what type of problems we're talking about and how you bucket them. So let me caveat this by saying that I feel like we're also in a massive bubble, which is not a hot take. That's like the most obvious thing in the universe with AI. And so I feel like the types of problems that we could be solving, I think are being eclipsed by the types of problems that people are fixated on in a bubble. These are not the same thing.
Yes.
Yep.
Very much. Yeah, I guess I've been thinking a lot about this question because, I've been in the field of machine learning before it was called AI, and I know that both of you have some exposure to this field too, and now everybody seems quite interested in machine learning and what it can do, which is great. This is a very positive thing. I think this is fantastic. But perhaps... spicy autocomplete that's mainly wrong is maybe like not the best problem that we can solve, perhaps. I don't know. I don't know. Matt, I hear you.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, machine learning has been around for some time. I mean, you can trace it way, way back, and it really started to impact our lives very directly, the public's lives, with Google search, right? That is a basic example of machine learning. And yet, this is something like you can get your hands on in a way you couldn't any of these other examples of machine learning, where you can like type a question and it answers, even if it's wrong. And that's very exciting for people, but it really does remind me a lot of the dot-com boom. Like, very much so. And there, I would argue, in the 90s, we were not solving the right problems. Eventually, we started solving the right problems, but it took a while.
What do you mean not solving the right problems, though, Matt? Because, I mean, a lot of the problems that we were trying to solve in the dot-com boom are now successful companies.
Yeah, I mean, I think in particular, at the time, there was a lot of pressure to launch websites, but it took a lot of time to for the technology to actually get socialized and useful. So pets.com, good idea, probably. There are lots of businesses now that sell pet-related merchandise. But just the business case there wasn't there at the time, right? It just wasn't all ticking to actually pay the bills. It was very much driven by the hype cycle and not by a real solid business case. And you can look at most of these businesses, aside from, say, Amazon.com and a handful that survived, and see that they just couldn't make the business work because people weren't ready for it and they weren't quite ready to reach the audience they needed to reach. I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
I mean, I was around in the 90s. I think we all were. It was... Okay, so I mean, okay, so let's decouple a couple things here, right? I kind of look at this as always, sort of to slice it out. So there was the euphoria part, which was great. I think what it did is it brought a lot of attention to the web and the internet that didn't otherwise exist. I mean, I was around before the web when I was online. And back then, it was different. Kind of miss those days, actually.
AOL? Were you on AOL?
No. No, I actually had an actual internet connection. I was on Usenet and all that stuff, the Well and early stuff. But AOL, my grandma was on it. That was cool. But no, I mean, that was, I think, what you called the information superhighway back then, right? That was because that was a walled garden. That's distinct from what the internet would have been. But okay, so a lot of interest in it all of a sudden. Everyone was making web pages. I was making web pages. Everyone had websites. And now it's something we take for granted. Right. So, but machine learning has been with us for ages, as we pointed out. Google was one manifestation of it. But I mean, if you look back even to stuff that was going on in the 90s, I mean, the computer vision is nothing new. That's been happening for a long time. And through the 2000s, but all these are research projects, right? So I think the if we kind of zoom to where today is, it feels like a lot of the companies that are in AI have either pivoted from non-quote AI companies to AI companies, and they're shoehorning AI into it, which is what you kind of saw in the dot-com days, where companies suddenly had websites. And then there's the other part of it, which is the actual stuff being done under the scenes, you know, behind the scenes, that I think is really useful. Research companies doing really cool stuff with machine learning applications. And I think that's, you know, I guess the problem is, and the founder of DeepMind, Demis, pointed this out last week, where he felt like we're definitely in a hype cycle, and what's at risk really is the amount of people doing research on real AI and machine learning problems and just going into, you know, trying to make a ton of money at companies that, you know, maybe have questionable utility long term. So that's kind of how I look at the progression from dot-com to today.
But I mean, I think you point out like two different things, and like maybe to further decouple. I mean, you're talking about a user-driven internet, right? You're talking about like everybody I knew had like GeoCities sites, and you could be on a web ring and all of these things. And so even though .com was available for large corporations, it was also available for like individual users.
Yep.
And in fact, like a lot of my friends got paid at like 16 to build websites for people's companies, which was pretty cool, you know?
But they made a lot of money too.
Yeah, well, in those days, right?
Yeah,
those
HTML. I mean, they
you could be a webmaster. Language.
Yeah,
exactly. You could even like run a server. Remember when people used to like run their own server somewhere? Anyways, but that's, I guess, like one of the questions that I have for us is like, I think one of the reasons why we're solving some problems but not other problems is because there's a limited amount of people that have the amount of resources needed, both data and let's say cloud compute, and or, you know, never ending budget for cloud compute that can make, you know, so-called AI today. And I think that that really like stifles creativity. I would love for it to be a bit more democratic or community driven or these types of things. I think that might produce a slightly different types of questions we would even want to solve with AI or with machine learning.
Matt, what do you think about the privacy aspects? I mean, you wrote a book on data privacy, so tell me about that. Like, how should people be thinking about the privacy aspects of AI? So there's the, are we solving the right problems? But there's also, what are the risks of this technology that we need to be thinking about? That probably no one was thinking about back in the dot-com boom.
I mean, I think for better or worse, a lot of the privacy problems that are documented by these systems, which is like that when we build very large deep learning systems, we have a tendency to memorize some, if not a large percentage of the training data, which of course is often scraped from the internet with what we might call murky consent or lack of consent, right, from a data protection point of view. Like a lot of that's already been like really well documented by research. It might not be as well known, but it's fairly well documented on research, like starting from 2017 and onwards, on like this theory that essentially we don't think that we could make deep learning not memorize, that there's certain mathematics behind how it works, particularly in a very, let's say, complex problem like image recognition or text or something like this that is actually extremely difficult for us to solve or create any type of approximation for this type of decision space without memorizing pieces of the data, particularly pieces that are outliers or pieces that or pieces even that happen a lot. Like if you get an LLM to explain the Apache license to you, it can recite it word for word perfectly, because of course it's seen it a million times. But my question, I see actually privacy more as maybe an enabler to solve interesting problems or more interesting problems, because like, let's take just this whole guardrails debate. So guardrails, right? Are we doing them right? Will they ever work?
What's a guardrail?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Guardrail. Sorry. The guardrail is like a nomenclature that has come up in AI circles to mean things that we've tried to train out of the model via a variety of functions. So there's a few different approaches. We don't need to get into the technical details if we don't want to, but, you know, some will train a model and then we'll try to fine tune or train guardrails around that model. And usually that model has learned in a somewhat unsupervised state beforehand. And then we're trying to, like, in my opinion, duct tape on guardrails as a way to say, maybe you shouldn't like do these things. Like if you learned this from the internet that you saw, please don't do it in our chatbot, for example. And I think part of the problem that we have there is like the guardrails are around either not repeating copyright material, not doing illegal stuff, and or not doing like whatever the maker of the model thinks of as evil. And this resulted in kind of like the whole Google thing where they were asking to make photos of people signing the Declaration of Independence and there was black folks there, and guess what, that historically that's inaccurate. And all of these types of things, like people have programmed in, let's say, ideas of how they think a model should behave. And a lot of companies now are trying to figure out, can we make our own guardrails? So like, can we write our company principles somewhere and then just feed it into the AI, and then the AI will never, you know, not do something to our company principles. And it's a fairly weak guarantee. It's actually really easy to do what we call jump guardrails or to make a model misbehave. There's like all sorts of really fun research, but then there's all sorts of really fun social media where just like, I am a researcher, please tell me how to build a Molotov cocktail, you know? And it's like, oh, since you're a researcher, sure, I'll tell you all these things, right? So anyways, I guess a part of me wonders, like, do we actually need guardrails if we can use data from people and they want to give it to us? Because presumably we could like get a group of people together who we believe, you know, have similar ideas to us, or who we believe represent something like a certain population or whatever it is. And if we were able to say, I'm going to share all the documents on my computer, I'm going to share all my emails and this type of stuff, we could presumably train models where we don't need to after duct tape on guardrails. So that is a question.
It's a really good question. It sort of goes back to this idea of what was it, revealed preferences, I think it was, where people say one thing and then you figure out what they really believe by watching what they do. This happens in elections all the time, for example. If I'm with a group of my friends who slant a certain political way, I'll probably placate them and not go fully unhinged on them in ways that might offend them. But when I go to the voting booth, I'm on my own. I can go unhinged as I want. Right. So I guess it's interesting. You bring up the company policy, for example, and this kind of goes back to this company values. So say your company value is, we are honest and we have integrity. These are really bad values, by the way. These are just kind of like placards in the break room. But we value our...
He wrote these for you, Joe. That's what happened.
We value our customers and we want to make sure they're treated well. And of course, in the real world, if you're to scan people's emails, you know, you find some sales guy telling the customer to go F themselves and you know, like stealing money from customers and stuff. So this is... But it's an interesting thing where you say, well, if I just had access to everyone's data, would that revealed preference just show up automatically? Where it's like, yeah, we say these things as a company, and guess what our behavior actually is?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess I've spent a lot of time working in privacy technology to deploy out systems that we couldn't do without privacy technology. So I mean, I was more thinking less in the direction of language models, but I think that would be interesting, and more in the direction of like, Joe, would you be willing to give information about the energy use of your household to the city if they were going to guarantee your privacy in order to build some sort of forecasting model they had? Like talking about a real problem, for example, not just an imaginary chatbot problem.
Yeah, it's more fun, actually. I don't know. Would you do that?
I definitely would. I mean, unfortunately, I don't think I think data protection regulation in Germany is strong enough that first I would have to tell the energy company that I'd like to, and then the Berlin state would have to figure out how are they going to handle the data and then end, which is, you know, why I've been thinking a lot about these types of problems. But I mean, it really is private data. Like, you can find out a lot of information about somebody by how the energy in their house works.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, let me tell you this. Like, I used to have a Nest thermostat, and for some reason, it doesn't work in my house just because of the way the prongs are set up, the way the house is wired. And actually, this is a great thing because I was going to get rid of it anyway. So, because I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I can give you all my other data. I mean, no one knows I have a smartphone that transmits all kinds of fun stuff, but... it's just one less thing to think about, right? But also in the U.S., like, I don't trust anybody with data, right? Yeah. It's almost like you're under the assumption, like, anything you do or say on any electronic device, or even if you're just out in public, really, because it's captured on cameras and Lord knows what else, like, that's fair game in the U.S. I'm always under the assumption that, yeah, anything I do or say is tracked already.
Do you actually change your behavior due to this? And Matt, I'd be curious to your answer, too.
I mean, I buy my cocaine in the old-fashioned way now. I'm kidding. So, yeah, I don't know, Matt. What do you do to change your habits?
That's a good question. I mean, I avoid most voice-activated devices, kind of like Joe, because I assume that they're going to be capturing a lot of stuff that, like, I'm not doing anything illegal, but I don't want people listening into my conversations 24 hours a day, right? And I always assume that I have one of these Alexa devices. That's probably what's going to happen at some point. Going back to the question, though, about, like, is it interesting to capture this private data? Can we do interesting things with it? I'm very interested in data in the healthcare space and just broadly, you know, all this data coming from fitness trackers and such. I think there's an opportunity to identify, like, population scale disease and population scale treatments that we've never seen before. But right now, that's a huge scary thing for people, and for me included, right? Where I just don't trust anyone to do that, and yet I see the opportunity and how that could dramatically change healthcare. I mean, a lot of improvements in healthcare have come from population level studies, but this would present so much more data than those studies allow us to gather.
Well, let me ask you this, Matt. If you were in a place like the EU, for example, that had strong data regulations and privacy protections, would you be more apt to want to do that kind of stuff there? Or is this more of a personal thing for you in general?
I mean, it's possible. I think part of what Catherine was getting at is that the EU regulations don't really accommodate these use cases. And I think there's a practice problem too, right? Where we in the data engineering and machine learning worlds haven't necessarily figured out how to do this in a way that's going to reassure users. I don't know. What do you think about that, Catherine? Like, how would we get to this point? It sounds almost magical, and yet there's just so much opportunity there.
Wait, which part seems magical?
The idea that you could, first of all, capture all this data in a way that's truly private, and the idea that we could also convince the population that it's private and still do interesting things with it in terms of identifying disease and identifying treatments for disease.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting, so I think we can borrow some ideas from our buddies in InfoSec, because security is kind of a little bit further along than privacy and like thinking through how do we make sure people don't go to like websites that are insecure? How do we communicate to users whether they should put this in a form or not? I mean, do they get it right all the time? No, but we do have things. We have like browser standards where we have little locks, and then we know like, okay, if the little lock is broken, maybe something's wrong. And there's been some thinking through, because I do think, Matt, I think you're touching on like the fact that a lot of this stuff is like a combination of a technical problem, but then like a user problem, like communicating with users and actually meeting them where they're at, rather than saying, oh, crypto, blah, 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 and then magic, you know. A lot of the book focuses obviously on the technical, or the book that I wrote focuses on the technical stuff, because there is some really cool math. Like if you got into data science or machine learning because you like math, there's really even much more fun math in the types of things that power privacy technologies. But aside from the nerdy technology side, there's a user communication problem, and that's like a trust issue. At the end of the day, you're asking people to trust you, and you're trying to tell them, you should trust me because blank. And like, maybe technology is one of them, but there's probably other things that have to go there too. Like, I provably have done this a few times and I'm not messing it up. Or like, Matt, your idea, like maybe it's legally binding that I only use this for research purposes and I don't immediately go sell it to your life insurance policy to get, you know, this or that thing changed, right? Mm-hmm.
Joe, you look like you have thoughts.
Well, I always have thoughts.
You always have thoughts, but like, let's...
Whether I should blurt them or not is a different story.
You're not quite as open as ChatGPT with your ideas. Well, if we all had Molotov cocktails, then...
I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Okay, I'll give you a mundane example. Like yesterday I got a new writing app that I fell in love with immediately. It's called Ulysses. It's great. So it allows you to organize everything in your, like for a book, for example, everything's organized. It's awesome. I'm going to show you guys this sometime. But then the question was, okay, so who has access to this data here? As far as I know, it lives locally. I could be wrong, but I think that was one of the big things, because it's like, I don't know. I just want those guardrails on the world doesn't need to be exposed to Joe's brain. Like, on a regular basis. So, and companies too. It's like, what are you going to do with this data, right? So, whereas, you know, when we wrote our book and in articles and stuff, we use Google Docs, right? But I guess the question is, like, what's that being used for, right? So these are the types of questions that just go through my head every day. It's like, okay, so who has access to this? And i.e. also, like, if something did happen, is this company, it's almost like, is the company big enough where if they have a major screw up, they don't want this to happen?
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a smaller company and they get a breach, is this one of those things where like, okay, they got a breach and they can't do anything about it because they're too small. So they'll just go out of, you know, that's a, I always think about those kind of consequences when I'm, you know, doing anything these days. Like what's, because you got to imagine anything you're doing these days is basically training data for something. Or it shows up in some kind of graph on some analyst's, you know, Tableau report or something, like here's our user behavior or something. So, I mean, I always, I don't know, just having done this work in the past, right? I mean, all of us have. It's like, you know, your everything you do is an input into something now. Yeah.
I think one of the alarming things that happened in the last couple of days. So I consider Google, oddly enough, a lot of people don't share this opinion, but having worked with Google quite a bit with their ads products and with their teams, I consider them to be one of the more privacy forward companies. Like they started doing privacy long, long before Meta. And yet it came out in the last week that in Chrome incognito mode that was supposedly private, they were capturing all kinds of information, and they finally admitted this and said they'd delete the data. And they've been doing this for years and years without, you know, publicly presenting themselves as privacy forward. And yet in this domain, they were capturing very private things.
Well, I think so, they said they weren't going to actually change that either. They said they're just going to delete the data. But yeah, just like now, you know, that the data is not actually private. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting because I think like part of the work that I do is I study research coming from places like Google and Meta. I've also had a chance to collaborate with some of them. But if you watch the research coming from these companies, you kind of also know what is happening with the data, which is really a fun thing to do. And in the fields that I've touched on, things like federated learning, things like encrypted computation, which is how do we combine data that's encrypted and still get a correct result without decrypting it. So we decrypt before the final result, obviously, but we don't decrypt the intermediary data or the input data. And when you follow this type of research, you end up seeing like a lot of really interesting things about data partnerships, data sharing, data collected from keyboards, like all of this type of stuff, because often they're kind of the inputs to these research comes out as part of, well, if we could do this, how would we go about doing it and still be compliant with data protection regulations? Mm. So it is a curious thing. I mean, the whole smart keyboard stuff, which was probably the predecessor to the LLMs that we have, a lot of that started with trying to play with how to do privacy technology on people's devices. Yeah. So that they could collect keyboard data without being like, we're literally collecting everything you type, which of course would have freaked a lot of people out. Oh, rightfully yeah. So, obviously.
Oh yeah, like I even, I subscribe to Grammarly. I only turn it on when I need to edit stuff. I turn it off otherwise. Because it'll track everything, right? And on your iPhone, they give you the option of having a Grammarly keyboard. I'm like, hell no, not doing that. Because you'll forget it's there. Meanwhile, they're tracking everything you do. Then the funny thing is, what tipped me off is you get a report at the end of each week. Like, your word, you know, your expressiveness in words and your vocabulary is amazing. Yeah, favorite word, pizza for me.
Well, just how much time does autocomplete complete your email, your phone number, your address? I mean, yeah. And this is why, like, I think it's really important. We could, I mean, there are ways that we develop this stuff so that stuff stays more local first, Joe, as you describe, like we're really like Ulysses, like you own the data, it's on your device. If it's backed up in cloud, it's like encrypted. And there's lots of ways we could do this, but we don't. And I guess that's part of my question about like the right problems is like, I would love to, was about to curse. I would love to have an Alexa. Like, I would love that. I want to like ask all sorts of questions to Alexa, but I definitely don't want to share whatever I want to ask with Amazon. Like, that is of zero interest to me. Like, I would pay a company good money if they could guarantee that my data stayed local. That's write me if you have a company doing this, because I would love to just chat with a weird voice assistant all the time. That would be fun.
Well, let me flip the question around then. Could we use AI to solve the right problems?
I mean, I absolutely love machine learning. Like, I've been doing this stuff for, I know, Joe, you have different opinions, but I've been doing this stuff for 10 years. And I really, like, I think that it's so interesting that we can solve a bunch of problems with cool math. Like, I just love that. And I think there's a lot of cool problems to solve. And I think we're fixated on, like, I think some of the most brilliant data scientists I know are fixated on how to get somebody to click something. And I think that's a really crap problem to solve. And sorry for saying that.
But no, that's it's an appropriate word to describe it as. And I think this is one of the things that I've been, well, Matt and I talk about this a fair bit, but it definitely feels like a misallocation of resources. But it's also maybe a misallocation of incentives and outcomes too, where because people are incentivized to go make a boatload of money at the big companies where you can optimize clicking on stuff, then that's what people do. Like, you know, if there were more incentives to stay in academia and do research, for example, on important problems, then I'm sure people would do that. But it's almost like making the choice to join a convent or something at this point. It's like, you know, or a monastery. It's just like, I could. But you know, I like sinful behavior and making money too, and these are diametrically opposed. But this is but you know, because academia is one of those things. Not to you know go off too much, but it's one of the things where making money is icky, right? It's just I mean, Matt joined the dark side. You're like,
I did. I flipped. Yeah, I was in academia for a while.
And why did you leave?
I mean, again, it really a lot of it came down to job prospects and the ability to retire and comfortably and a lot of other things and just basic job security. You would think that academic jobs are always very secure, but that's unless you're on, you know, elite tenure track. That's not necessarily the case in the tech industry. You can lose your job at any time, but you always figure you can find something else to do. And actually in academia, that can be much, much harder. Mm-hmm. If you get let go after a contract period, it can be very, very hard to find another job somewhere else.
Well, and economically, Matt, how much more money would you make staying as a professor with insecure job prospects versus getting a job in industry? You don't have to throw out numbers, but give me a percentage.
A lot less.
Yes.
Like, dramatically less. Yeah.
So this is kind of the crux of it, right? Where I think you're absolutely right, Catherine. It's like there's a ton of problems that I wish we could use AI to solve a lot of these right problems. But it seems we're overweight on solving a lot of problems. Well, it sort of reminds me of what happened with the internet, right? The first thing people were like is, when the browser came out, how can I, e-commerce, it was one of the first applications of it. Like, how can I take what's in the real world and start, having people buy things online, right? And like, it's always been about shopping and, adult stuff is really what the internet's always been about.
So. That sounds great. Yeah. I mean, I think,
true.
I think, yeah, it's true. And I want to put out here that I don't think anybody should question being able to retire comfortably and do a cool problem with AI. Like, I honestly just think maybe there's cool problems that we can incentivize that also can be good job paths for people. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's part of the question. I mean, the interesting thing of bringing up the early internet is like it was originally a research project, right? Yep. And it was also had a bunch of government funding. And like, obviously, I live in a place that has a lot more government funding than some places. But I also think there's really interesting problems also that the U.S. government, for example, could or should or would fund. But I think that the way that it's gone is like, I don't know if either of you remember, I think Al Gore said that like he helped invent the internet because I think he was on the panel that approved some of the funding for the internet
and such, yeah.
Which is great. Like, but I think like, honestly, like hat tip to Al Gore because like, I can't think, and there's probably some, but I can't think of any representatives I know of who would have enough knowledge to connect like a funding bill for this technology with what actually happens in AI, for example.
Right.
And like, that's part of the problem is like, there's all this mystique around AI, but like explaining it plainly so people could be like, cool, let's fund that. Like, let's do private Alexa or let's do whatever, you know, that like there has to be somebody that understands it enough that government signs off on funding and or companies decide, you know what, there's another incentive. And I think like Apple is the classic example versus kind of the Google Metas of saying like privacy is a core product value and we're going to offer privacy with everything we do and.
Well, yeah. I mean, even if when you look at the motivations behind Meta doing open source, for example, right, with Llama, it's simply to keep people in the Meta ecosystem. it's not an altruistic thing, right? Versus, okay, you talk about the internet. 1.5 miles from me is the University of Utah. That was one of the, I think, the third or fourth node of the internet back then, of ARPANET, right? And that was built because, well, there was a thing called the Cold War, and we needed to figure out how to redundantly communicate in the event of a Soviet nuclear attack. You had every motivation in the world to do this. Whereas AI right now, I think it's a bit of a whitewashed term in some sense. We're like, okay, so I travel to these conferences around the world, right? Everyone's doing AI. Every conference that would have been something else now has everything AI. And when I look at a lot of the things that are, quote, AI, I kind of scratch my head at where the AI is in a lot of these products that these vendors are talking about, but everything has AI. I'll say that the things where I notice it's actually getting the cool stuff I see with, quote, AI, and also the scary stuff simultaneously is using, you know, I'll call it machine learning, computer vision at scale, for example, right? You know, to do like an entire dragnet for criminals. Like there was a big demo of that at a conference I was at. And I was like, okay, that's, I think, an incredibly interesting use case, right? We're able to catch, kidnappers and stuff using all the cameras on the street and all the cameras everywhere. But also that it's a double-edged sword, right? Is this a right problem to solve with AI is a question I kept having. Right. I mean, it's an obvious use case. Like when I think of AI use cases, like this fits squarely in it. Using AI to look at your Excel report, I think, is a pretty lame use case. It's not as interesting. Right. This problem has been solved for ages. Right. Or like using AI on your ERP system. I'm like, that's cool. That's not the kind of marginal gains you're going to, you know, it's not the exponential gains you're going to get with machine learning, like in the use case where I said, where it's like, yeah, now I can use every data point in the world to do a dragnet on somebody, criminals, mm-hmm. and bring it down the organization. Like, that's interesting, but also, like, you, Catherine, I'm sure have opinions on the side effects of this. You couldn't solve these types of problems otherwise. What are you going to do? Have like a billion policemen out there looking for people?
Yeah, I mean, we could also think of like basic tracking technologies, right? Mm-hmm. So like when AirTags got released, it was like, oh, great, I'm never going to lose my device. But then it's like, oh, I could also never lose my kid. Oh, it could also stalk my ex-girlfriend. You know what I mean? Like, it goes like pretty quickly mm-hmm. down a path. And that's like, I mean, technology doesn't often have its own incentives built in. But interestingly enough, machine learning, I would argue, does. As in, machine learning's job is to discriminate.
Yeah.
That's his job. Like, it's literally called a discriminator, right? Like, it looks at something, it has to make a decision, right? Or it takes something and it has to decide what to output. And of course, it's all a probability based end and end, so it could change. But I mean, when we build a machine learning system, particularly for a particular task, or even when we build a generic one, we ask it to do a specific thing. And I think that's where it's like really interesting, because how we choose to use it maybe says something about, yeah, what we think the right problem is, right? For example.
And the problem too is that machine learning isn't just a neutral observer of human beings, right? It's not like aliens came down and are observing humans and figuring them out.
Maybe they did, Matt.
Well, maybe they did, but that might be happening also. But
it's the eclipse today too, by the way. That's actually true. An alien species. Yeah.
But it's fundamentally, it's absorbing human data. And that means any biases that are built into human data just get trained into the system. Or with ChatGPT, it's not like this arbitrary intelligence that understands humanity and has good intentions. It just absorbs whatever's out there on the internet. And that, as we know, the internet is just a great place with only positive thoughts on it.
When I think it became like a big debate for people like artists and creators, like journalists, authors, like everybody on this call, because, you know, it has been shown, like, this is the New York Times now active lawsuit against OpenAI and now Microsoft, is like, you can regurgitate entire New York Times articles, like, that's our material. So there's this whole debate, you know. But like, speaking of right problems, I mean, Joe, a lot of the computer vision got a lot better, not only due to contributes like from Facebook and social media, which was like, can we recognize the same person? And I don't know if either of you were on Facebook when they first turned on facial recognition, but it was terrifying because I was in college and all of my photos should not have been tagged. The worst feature. I remember they rolled it out, and at first there was no way to untag yourself. And I was like, no. I have to shut down my entire profile.
Well, like, teachers got fired.
What was your, what's your Facebook profile?
No, it's deleted now. So thank you, GDPR.
No, people lost their jobs over this. I mean, you had cases where, you know, a teacher would be like out drinking, doing adult type stuff, and they post it on Facebook, and then their students through facial recognition would find it like bad, just like,
yeah. Oh no, my kids do this all the time. This is kind of fun. This will make sense. So they have teachers. So my 13-year-old has a fake LinkedIn profile along with his friend, and they just look at their teachers and they go on their teachers' Facebooks and do exactly what you just said.
Yep. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it's pretty hilarious, actually. My kid actually does have a LinkedIn profile, which is pretty funny too. Because he gets on my show once in a while and comments. And I'm just like, you're a jackass. But
okay, now we have enough information to deduce how to find. This is a terms of service violation, I'm pretty sure. But but I mean, I guess, like, if we go beyond, like, if we choose non-creepy problems, like, maybe it's more interesting. Like, I would love to occasionally listen to a podcast in a different language and have it like auto magic translate to another language. Like, I want to read books that I have in paper, like, via my device. Like, couldn't there be like a robot that just turns the page and reads to me like while I'm cooking or something like this? I mean, there's a bunch of, I think that there's a wealth of things that could be done if we weren't focused on clicks and or spicy autocomplete. I don't know. Just a thought.
No, it totally makes sense. I mean, everyone wants the like helper robot that can just cook clean for them, right? And that part we're not quite getting to yet. Like, we've had the Roomba for how long, and it's not that smart.
Think about what that thing is supposed to do, though, right? It's supposed to clean your house, but what else does it do?
Send photos on the internet to, you know, content observers, test labelers.
Yeah, it's a mapper for your house. I mean, it's no secret why Amazon bought it. I can have every square inch of your house mapped and sell you a bunch of stuff. Again, it's all about selling stuff at the end of the day. It's just how it is, right? So I don't know. Can let me ask you this, Catherine. So you live in Europe. You're also American. I think you have two different perspectives on the societies. Do you, in Europe, I would say it's, I would like to think it feels more pure than the US. I know I'm delusional and lying, but do you see use cases there, because there's so much regulation, do you see use cases for machine learning where you're like, this isn't sleazy. Like, this is for societal good. This is to help improve, the lot of the people there.
I mean, I honestly think you can find really cool use cases no matter where you are. I think, as Matt pointed out, like, a lot of folks that I know that work in the healthcare space, particularly like people that partner with healthcare providers, a lot of that stuff is really admirable, so to speak. I think a lot of research, which is often like cross projects between industry and researchers, ends up being in this space. And I would really say that I think that there's more companies now that are saying, okay, like, we all know how startups or venture works. Like, what's our differentiator? And some people are starting to say, like, okay, our differentiator is going to be privacy, or it's going to be something that allows people to feel more trustworthy, like, take Signal. I mean, Signal, you know, obviously, like, is a mixture of developers from the US and Europe, but end-to-end encryption. I mean, before it was WhatsApp, and that's why, you know, Meta bought WhatsApp. And it was a real fight to have WhatsApp turn on end-to-end encryption. Mm-hmm. But now you see, like, now a lot of platforms are rolling out end-to-end encryption and saying, like, actually, we don't really want you to know that we can look at all of your data without your permission and stuff. And so I think it's less about where you are, and it's more about what is the consumer, I think, knowledge, like, do people know how data is being collected and used? And then the pressure happens automatically, right?
Yeah. Okay, so you're a security and privacy expert. For the audience out there, what are some things that they can do to protect themselves against intrusive behavior?
I mean, from whom?
That's a good question. What do you do? Or can you say generically? Or what do your friends do to protect themselves? Maybe from if they're on the internet, for example, we'll start with that. What are some things I can do to make sure my data is being anonymized or not used?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because it kind of depends on what your, like, I'm going to use the security term threat model is. And I don't know, have you talked about threat models on
Let's talk about them.
So, like, your threat model, like, let's say that you're, you know, just normal user chit-chatting on the internet, clicking stuff, you know, you, and let's say even just take a normal case, you don't want your roommate or your housemate or your life partner to know that you're going to buy something for their birthday. So, like, maybe don't search for it on your home internet. Use your mobile internet. And even then it could, they can sometimes commingle these data or something. So search for it on a different internet that you can use, or use a VPN or something like this. Because the problem is, and if people who have worked a long time in the data space probably know this, is a lot of those feeds are combined based on things like IP address, based on, you know, the network IDs that end up being saved on your device. And therefore, it's like known that you kind of live around this area, that here's home, maybe here's work, and that these advertisers change a lot of information. In case you don't know, also most of your credit card transactions end up being sold directly to advertisers. So that's why sometimes ads are creepy and they know what you're doing. It's not actually that your device is listening to you. It's just that we've gotten very good at personalization. So, like, maybe think about creatively about how you use your internet, how you use what devices, and just know that, like, private browsing doesn't necessarily mean private browsing, which now everybody knows, which is great. But if, like, your threat model is you're an activist and you, or like you're doing something that in your state may be seen as illegal, then, like, you have to have a totally different threat model, because literally then any data could potentially show up in a warrant and be used against you. So that type of hygiene, so to speak, as we say in security, is very difficult and is getting more and more hard, because I'm sure that you've seen on TV, like, burner phones and stuff like this. Like, now those don't even really exist anymore. And there's transparency reports that a lot of companies give every year. It's worthwhile taking a look at the transparency reports of services that you use if they release them, or asking for people to do it, because it also shows the amount of warrants that were issued by what nations, how many were fulfilled, how many were not. But that's really only meaningful if, like, that's the level of security or threat model you're talking about. If you're just, let's say, concerned about normal privacy, the most boring and probably also legitimate advice I would offer you is maybe to learn how to read privacy policies and to read them.
That sounds exciting. Thanks for the homework.
There's a part of the book that does this, by the way, Joe, if you want a shortcut.
Nice. Okay. So we can learn about all the terminology that's standard in these really dense legal documents.
Can I sort it in the ChatGPT and have it summarize it for me? That was a joke, by the way.
I haven't yet tried this. There was, though, a few projects where people tried to build NLP that summarized. And the problem is, if it hallucinates, then, yeah.
Let me ask you this, though. So you talk about companies and organizations that have transparency policies. How much do you actually believe these?
Joe, you're just like, Joe doesn't believe, trust any data that Joe sees, I see.
I mean, the first thing is, I don't know, is it a rookie mistake to say, like, I trust your transparency report on how honest you are, right? Is that a bad mindset to have?
It's definitely going, starting to go like deep state type.
Should I browse for a discount on for BetterHelp? and seek some therapy for my paranoia. No, but it's a legitimate thing. When I see these transparency reports, I'm like, that's great. How do I know you're telling me the truth?
I mean, yes, I hear you, but I think you don't, it's not legally binding to release a transparency report. So yeah. One could imagine if you bother having somebody assigned to look into transparency, that this is something that a company is doing to try to like build trust, essentially. But yeah, I think this is why it's really interesting. Okay, different angle of this entire thing is independent journalism. And I know Joe knows, but Matt, I don't know if you know, I actually started my career in journalism. That was my first career. Ah, yeah.
Okay.
I was a data journalist. First at the Washington Post was my first job. And it's, I think it's a bit of a tragedy what's happened with independent and deep investigative journalism over time. Cause I think that like the best would be that we can trust journalists to like dive in and make their own transparency report. But I don't know how to make independent and like thorough journalism come back. But I'd be interested. Not ChatGPT. I don't think ChatGPT should be a journalist.
Let me follow on the privacy discussion and jump back to that. What do you think about this like huge backdoor that was found in Linux like the last couple of weeks? I mean, if we have good transparency policies and laws, we have to worry about someone injecting an attack into Linux. People are saying a deep state actor that captured data across all kinds of devices.
Deep state actor? I'm just kidding.
Well, no, that's what they're saying. I mean, what the argument was that specifically that this was probably a foreign government because the amount of
explain
resources.
What happened, Matt. Explain for
so
the
specifically,
audience.
I don't understand all the technical details, but basically in the Linux kernel, there's something called, I believe, XZ tools. Is that right? And in the code, someone over a period of years built trust with the Linux community and then got commit rights and then basically, go ahead, Catherine.
That's exactly how it happened. Yeah. Just because like this is another, this is actually really related to the questions that we're asking now. So it was an open source repo. It's a helper repo. It's not part of like core Linux, but it's a helper repo. It's built into a lot of Linux systems. It had one maintainer.
No.
Who is around about our age and has a family and a life and a job, never got paid to maintain this tool, kept asking the community for help. Somebody volunteered. That person, exactly as you say, Matt, built trust over time. Eventually, this person was like, cool, I'm going to hand over the keys to the kingdom to you. Here they are. And like within a week had like 5,000 backdoors. So, and there is some suspicion on a state level and this type of thing. But like my main question for that with this right problems, and this goes right back to Joe's point about incentives, is like, why don't we fund open source? Like, why don't we fund open source AI systems too? Like PyTorch is still from Meta, you know, like there's no open machine learning, whatever. I mean, it's either Google or Meta. Or maybe some NVIDIA flavors that are available. I mean,
no, I totally agree. And also, this was found out.
Someone in Germany, right?
Freund is his last name. Yeah, but he. And I was doing actually a podcast at the Changelog last week. We were talking about this problem, and the guy said it was kind of like Steph Curry. I guess when he dribbles he's dribbling a basketball. This example would make sense. And on the court, and I guess he's so in tune with how the floor should feel that he felt a dead spot in the basketball court. And this was pretty much Freund, like when he found Freund, however you pronounce it. But anyway, he saw this almost by accident because he's looking at the time it took for an SSH to Ron, and he's like, this is unusual. Something's not, something that doesn't jive here. So he dug into it and dug into it and dug into it and dug into it. He's like, oh crap. Cause I read the report that he published, the cry for help. And it's like, yeah, we've been backdoored in no uncertain terms. It's like, it was scary because you got the implications of this would have been the internet potentially could have been brought down to its knees.
Yes.
Not even exaggerating. And so that would have happened if not for this freak accident, actually, of this guy finding us.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But yeah, incentives. So it's interesting. We had Max Howell on the show several months ago. So he's the person who created Homebrew. And you want to talk about like exactly what you're talking about, unpaid, you know, open source, right? And Homebrew is like one of the most popular open source projects on the planet. And for a long time, it was just Max, you know, and he was like, yeah, I was broke, basically, you know. So he started, TXYZ is his new project. The T projects that helped, you know, kind of help remunerate open source contributors. But yeah, I mean, who was it? The person who's in charge of requests, the Python library, I think I was reading that only brought in like $12,000, and it's only one of the most widely used Python libraries in the world. It's a labor of love.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, it's a national security issue, right? Yes. Like, and it's a corporate security issue. And so I guess, like, to some degree, some of the trillions of budget maybe should go to software. I mean, I don't know. It's a wild idea, but since everything's connected, maybe we should. And it would be really cool if there was some open source ML stuff, then maybe people could play with some of this stuff, and not just from Meta and whatever, but also some from large funded research projects and not just mini funding.
And I think the perception in the United States is that in the past, the government did fund a lot of research. You can really argue that the U.S. government created, and the European government to some extent, but especially the U.S. government created the aerospace industry. Like, they spent so much money developing military aircraft, and then that ended up in civilian aircraft and a lot of different spaces. The perception now is that the government just can't move fast enough to do anything interesting in tech. And also, the big tech companies are so well funded that even the government has trouble keeping up. So, for example, I was reading that Alphabet now has like over $100 billion in the bank that they can deploy however they want. They can spend on any project. The government looks at those numbers and like, yes, the U.S. government budget is much larger than that. But to dedicate that to technology research just seems unthinkable, even at the scale of the United States government. And so how do we solve those problems? Like, how do we allow governments to move faster in tech? And how do we get the sums of money required to do this kind of research?
KJ, you have 3 minutes. Go.
But I think rather than the solution, I think that's the right question. I think if everybody was asking that question, the conversation would be much more interesting than who's deployed AI in their silly customer assistant bot, which nobody is going to use. And if so, it may or may not. I don't know if you saw the Air Canada case, but it may or may not involve him paying somebody's legal fines, which is like, yeah, it's silly and fun. And I don't mean to like, I'm sure some developer worked on that, and I hope you're not listening. And I'm sorry for you, man, because I'm sure you're just trying to build AI into something. But I mean, lots of empathy to that. But it's like the more interesting problem is, what could we solve if we actually funded AI differently? And I think that's, that was the conversation I was hoping to have. So thank you.
Did you have that conversation?
Yeah, I feel good.
Okay,
can good. Go on a walk
Otherwise,
now.
Otherwise, we'll have to have you on again to talk. We'll have you back on again anyway.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Kind of closing out, do you have anything you're working on right now or anything you can talk about that's awesome that you're really stoked about?
I may or may not have some interesting news coming over the summer, but I can't, nothing's definitely set for sure, but it may be around some of the themes that we talked about today, which is quite exciting. So if you want to stay in touch, obviously I'm on LinkedIn and so forth. And I have a nerdy newsletter. If you like reading about nerdy math privacy stuff, please, you can sign up and follow
really
my work.
Nerdy. What's it called? It's actually a really cool name. It's
called Probably Private.
Probably Private. Love it. Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Probability and privacy and stuff. And yeah, I will also be writing a book. So the book I wrote is like very much for data scientists, machine learning people. Which means it's really, maybe not for everybody. So I'll also be writing a book on privacy technologies for non-technologists, in case you want to get anybody in your family some nice Christmas reading. Maybe it'll come out around that time.
Nice Christmas reading.
Don't you want to learn how anonymization actually works in theory and practice, Joe, for
I would.
In your family, for your son?
I'll get that for him for sure.
Your son should know about this.
There will be comics.
He should. Well, he's pretty old school. He's just yeah. It's funny that some kids I think actually get this better than adults. They're just like, yeah, I'm not doing that. I want to let everyone know what I'm doing. I'm like, yeah, it's crazy. But you know, anyway, that's a topic for a different day. Matt, anything you got going on this week?
Let's see. Yeah, Day Day Universe in New York City is coming up in a couple of days. So,
yay. Yeah. It's going to be a fun one. What event are you doing there, Matt?
I'm going to be moderating a panel. So we're going to be talking about the convergence of data engineering and machine learning to some extent.
Sounds really boring.
Probably will be. I don't know.
I'm kidding. Cool. Then what is it? Next month and some change, you and I are giving a workshop in Malaga, Spain on data engineering.
Yeah.
So it's at J on the Beach if you're interested in going to Malaga. Terrible place, by the way. Just
gorgeous.
Yeah, it's actually, yeah.
Been there. Okay. This will be my first time.
It's pretty cool. Come check us out. I'll be in Chicago doing an event with Matillion on the 23rd of April. So catch me outside. And apart from that, what else is going on? That's about it, really. A bunch of other stuff that I can't talk about yet, but you'll find out soon. So, I think the early drafts of my book will be out on practicaldatamodeling.substack.com this week and the week after and the week after that and so on. So if you want to read about that, go subscribe. Next week, we have David Yaffe. We're going to be talking about live data stack, streaming, all that fun stuff. And I think John Coutet is on the next week, also talking about streaming. So we got AI this week, streams, more streams, and then a bunch of other stuff. I can't remember. But anyway, thanks, everybody. What's that?
Yeah, we're going to look at Google Event Arc sometime, right, Joe? We were kind of excited about this. So we'll have something to say about that at some point. I don't know.
There's a lot of cool stuff happening. There's a lot of cool stuff happening, yeah. And who better to talk about it than two of the dorkiest guys on the planet? So,
exactly.
Yep, that's it. Catherine, always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Yeah, okay. All right, take care. Bye.